Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the HTI-1 Proposed Rule Task Force. My name is Mike Berry, and I'm with ONC, and I'd like to thank you for joining us today. All of our task force meetings are open to the public, and your feedback is always welcomed, which can be typed in the Zoom chat feature throughout the meeting, or could be made verbally during the public comment period that is scheduled toward the end of our meeting this morning. I'd like to begin roll call of our task force members, and this is for Group 2. 203. And so when I call your name, please indicate that you are here. And I'll start with our co-chairs, Stephen Lane.
Good morning.
Steve Eichner.
Good morning.
Madel Briggs Melanson.
Good morning, everyone.
Hans Blumdeck.
Good morning.
Jim Gerges. Anna McAllister is not able to join us today. Aaron Meary. PK Lama Ocean Kenton.
Oops, morning. Rough start. Sorry.
Good morning, Daya. Mary Sunder Rajan.
I'm here. Good morning.
Bill Sutherland. And Cheryl Turney.
Good morning.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you. So now please join me in welcoming Stephen Lane and Steve Eichner for their opening remarks.
Good morning and welcome all. Mike, I think Jim Gerges is just connecting now. Thank you all for joining us this morning to begin the Task Force Group 2's work today, continuing the work that was started yesterday in the overall Task Force meeting. We've got some good stuff before us. We're going to go over the worksheets just a little bit, go back into DSI and produce module discussion, and then have some public comment. And Stephen, do you have anything to add?
No, let's get into it.
So just as a quick refresher, we do have a charge from the ONC. We are not going to go through each of the slides in detail, but just looking at it, was the overall charge is to evaluate the content of the proposed rule and provide feedback in select areas to ONC by the close of the comment period. And you've got the slides both from today and historically looking at those charges. We will continue to include them in future presentations for convenience, but we will not be revisiting them in detail unless, of course, there is a change in the charge. Let's go into the next slide just for folks' reference. Again, this group will be looking at a variety of things, including, you know, DSI, electronic case reporting, which version of USCDI, and some other things. So the way that the task force documents its progress and it helps build its recommendations is through use of a Google Sheets worksheet that includes both original material and reference to links in the existing rules or the proposed rule, as well as a number of fields for task force members to use in presenting recommendations and actually building content. I think, Sarah, are you going to be able to show your screen?
I'm working on that right now.
Wonderful. And the way that you get to the worksheets is through a link that ONC is providing through its homework emails that you should receive on a regular basis. If you need documentation in other formats, please do reach out to ONC. We do recognize that there are some organizations that may have some challenges in granting access to Google Sheets, and there are some workarounds that are in place. So Sarah, let me give the floor to you.
Can y'all see my screen?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, excellent. Well, here's the proposed rule summary for the decision support interventions and predictive models proposal. This is a high level summary that's been taken from the executive summary in the preamble. We also have this link for the Federal Register where you can find the full preamble. And then it looks like there's been some comments already added. And I'll turn it back to you.
Sure. Well, just to add on, at the bottom of the window are the different tabs for the different groups. And this group will be focusing on the content on the Group 2 tab. You can also see the work being done in Group 1 and Group 3, and also include information or comments in that space. We do ask for every time that you are entering a comment that you enter information just before the comment, such as M. Briggs has done on the screen, to kind of identify who's making the comment, so that as we're looking at discussing it, if there are future questions about it, we can understand who's made the suggestion, so we can track it back, and if there's additional information or additional explanation needed, we have a way of getting back to who contributed the information. During our Zoom meetings, there is a raise hand feature down at the bottom of the screen. We encourage folks to use it. Stephen and I and other folks will be monitoring the chat to help bring things that are of interest to the group at large in the chat, making sure that we're aware of them. So please take advantage of both of those opportunities to contribute. Sarah, looking at the meeting topic schedule tab at the bottom, if you want to touch on that really quickly. Okay, so what we have here is an additional tab that lays out the full meeting schedule for all task forces or all subgroups and all task forces throughout the duration of the project, identifying both the meeting dates and what the subject is going to be, or the subjects are going to be for the meetings. We do have a couple of larger group meetings later in the schedule as we move towards finalizing our recommendations. The final document will be a Word document or a text-based document that ONC and Excel will be helping build by extracting data from the worksheet and then converting that into a written document where we can also make comments and finalize text. So that's kind of the workflow that we're going to go through. Duration. Are there any questions or concerns?
I mean, one thing that I would add, Ike, is that as you've all noticed, Ike is taking the reins here for our Wednesday meetings, as I did a bit yesterday. Peng Lu is going to be leading the Thursday meetings with the rest of us providing support. Today, I'll be trying to monitor the hand raising and the chat, and we will divide and get through this work. I also really wanted to thank Medell for showing up with the first comment in the Group 2 tab of the spreadsheet. In fact, I think it may be the first comment anywhere in the spreadsheet. So all as usual, Medell got her homework done first, and we really appreciate that, and including the thoughtful comment here on this item, the DSI item that we're discussing today.
And comments are always welcome on any of the items up until the point which we want to close discussion on any particular item. It's a little advantageous for us if you make comments on a particular item that's on the agenda for a given week, to make those comments at least a couple hours before the meeting, so that we've got an opportunity to preview them before the meeting. And you're always welcome to contribute. That it's a guide, not a requirement, in terms of looking at giving us a couple of hour window to prepare. So if you can, fantastic. If not, we do appreciate the comments at any point.
Another point I'd make is that we added that meeting topic schedule tab so that you could be looking ahead at what is coming in subsequent weeks and meetings. If there are topics that you would like to participate in reviewing that are in a different work group, you are more than welcome to attend that work group, either as a task force member or a member of the public. Also, if there are particular subject matter experts that we should be reaching out to participate in any of these topic-focused discussions, please let us know so that we can make those contacts and get that on the schedule.
And to add on to that, we are looking to subject matter experts that are not task force members in potentially a couple of different roles. One, to just join a particular meeting as a subject matter expert without a prepared presentation, but also certainly if the topic needs it or there's particular expertise or a perspective that needs to be shared that might be supported by a presentation, those are also most certainly welcome. The goal here is to ensure that the task force members have as much information, as much useful information as is possible without creating an undue burden on the folks that are willing and able to share that information.
Also, a response to the question submitted, Mike, you just got to it, by Ian Schefferman. Thank you for your interest in the sheet. But the Google Docs that we use for these task forces are kept to the task force themselves. They have edit access, and while the public is welcome to view them during the course of the meeting or in the subsequent recordings, we don't provide access to the public. All right.
So I guess we are ready to move on to our next agenda item, which I believe is getting back into DSI.
And I think where we left off yesterday was that we had a couple of open questions or hand raise. Anna and Hans both finished the meeting with their hands up. And here's Hans at the ready with his hand up again. So why don't we try to complete that discussion?
All right. Thank you, Stephen and Ike. Yeah, to pick up from the questions, and it was a little bit, my question was in line with some of Devin's questions as well. And maybe to rephrase it a little bit this way. I think it was very clear from the explanation that Jeffrey provided that an EHR that is currently certified to 9A, is expected to certify to 10 or 11B. I still get the numbers mixed up a little bit, but with the DSI update. The question was really around if you have other HIT that provides abilities, are they in some way through other incentives compelled to certify to this capability? That's where I think there were still a little bit of open questions to make sure we understood the context, which may in turn help understand what kind of other comments or recommendations we may want to make or not. And that is, if you have HIT that is otherwise not considered a base EHR or doesn't want to consider that, they always can be certified to these modules as they see fit. But it's only at this point in time market drivers, not regulatory or other incentive drivers, that would compel them to do that. So if you have either a patient-focused app that might do some DSI, if you have a healthcare operations capability that may include some DSI, if a EHR is interacting, let's say initiating through CDS hooks and connects with another capability that does some DSI and particularly some AI that it then takes back, maybe there's some clarification there. But other than that, is that ONC, as much as that the certification is enabled for HIT, there beyond EHRs, there is no current other known incentive beyond market drivers to actually certify it to this and also then other capabilities. Just want to make sure that that context is clear, as that might lead to some recommendations or considerations as well. Did I get that right? Other than the there is an EHR CDS hooks connected with an AI capability, there are some particular parts that that you do have some things, but not on the other AI capability. That's the part that I think was still left from yesterday to clarify.
Mike, do you want to take that, or any of the ONC team, just to confirm what I think Khan said, which to me sounds correct?
Yeah, so this is Jeff, and I think I track Hans your comment, and I think the answer to your question may become clearer as we walk through some of the slides, and we're able to provide the scope for the kinds of basically provide scope around the nexus of our regulatory authority or proposed regulatory authority. I think broadly you are correct that the module that certifies to A9 would be required to update to B11. That module, if it enables or interfaces with a technology that meets the predictive DSI definition, would then be subject to additional transparency requirements. However, if there was another health IT system, and I think the patient-facing app is maybe a good example. If this patient-facing app was not enabled by or interfaced with a health IT module, then this patient-facing app and its predictive DSI would not be required to adhere to our transparency requirements. So it's understandably, complex, but I'm hopeful that as we walk through some of the slides, we can get a little more clarity. And then, you know, I think the last thing I'll say is that we've got in the deck that we're gonna walk through, we've got just a couple of clarifying disclaimers that we need to keep in mind as we move forward.
That helps, and I'm looking forward to the rest of the year presentation to help fill that in as to who is actually be responsible for what. If you take the patient app, the EHR, other HIT that provides DSI capabilities, and depending on how they're connected, to understand who really is required to be certified, who is voluntary can do it, but is otherwise not required to by ONC or otherwise like CMS or another program has no obligation to certify other than market drivers. So as we go through, I'll keep track of my clarifications and questions left.
And Hans, if you want to add your understanding perhaps in column I under task force discussion, just so that we have that captured. Sure. I was thinking of doing that for you, but you're so good with words. I also wanted to just add one comment, which is to say just market forces is I think to understate the power of these guidelines in the way that we've seen with the Karen Alliance and the voluntary engagement around standards for privacy specifically around patient-facing apps. I think there's going to be a real opportunity for the market to pick up these guidelines and requirements, and to be able to say that the DSI that they are implementing in their product, even a non-certified product, does meet these guidelines. I think we should be prepared for that in such a way that ONC should be prepared for that specifically, so that when those claims are made, that there's some way for the market to be assured that they are valid. I mean, I don't know offhand. Yeah, I mean, again, this is sort of isn't what the Karen Alliance is about, but I mean, the whole, you know, in the Karen Alliance, the way it's done is that the CEO of the company signs something, and it's as official as one can get without it being an actual law. But I think we should just be thinking ahead about how to leverage this for the benefit of the larger industry beyond certified health IT. Sorry, was that you, Jim?
Yeah, hey, quick comment. I just want to remind everybody, too, that these rules are around the certified technology as stated today. But don't forget, the FDA has released a guidance document, for example, that is broader, and it uses its authority to regulate medical devices and has defined some of these predictive decision support models within their guidance document. In that guidance document, in particular, patient-facing apps, 100% of those would be considered devices that would need to be regulated by the FDA. So this isn't the only lever, and it seems like this lever is targeting currently defined certified technology, but there's other non-market levers in the government, like the FDA. I just want to remind us of that. And remember, Mickey and his coordination activities has been working closely with the FDA in drafting this.
So, this is Steve, just to add on to that as part of today's presentation, and maybe Catherine and Jordan and Jeffrey can address it at the appropriate point in their presentation, is looking at what does integration or connectedness mean in the context of the requirements, and what's a component of certified technology, and what might be ancillary, you know, whether it's an integrated module or a connected piece of technology down the line. That would certainly add some clarity or add some opportunity or some guidance for the task force in being able to contribute contents or comments in the right space.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll spend some time on a slide that we've got, and I'm happy to try and provide clarity or clarify on that point. Okay, so I'm going to take the wheel today. My colleague Jordan Everson is on tap to speak to some of the source attributes if we get that far. And a quick scan of the attendee list I think reveals that Catherine is not currently on. I know she has had additional obligations today. So if we could go to the next slide, that'd be helpful. Okay, just real quick, we had a different disclaimer slide that was a little outdated. And in fact, it was a disclaimer slide for kind of presentations based on final rules, not necessarily on proposed rules. And this disclaimer should have been offered yesterday. So I'll spend just a moment on this so that we're all clear. We are doing our best to try and provide a synthesis of what we have proposed in the health data technology and interoperability proposed rule. Because we are in the throes of the rulemaking process, we have to comply with the Administrative Procedures Act. And so we can only really present the information that is in the proposed rule as it's contained in the proposed rule. So this means we can't really interpret information or clarify or provide further guidance than what is in the proposed rule. Of course, we're not going to read you the proposed rule. So what we're going to try and do is provide you key concepts and do our best to explain those concepts, as well as leverage the content that is in the proposed rule. But I can't stress enough, especially for a complicated subject as this, how important it is to actually read the proposed rule. The other thing I'll say, just again, so everybody's clear, When you make these wonderful comments and you ask these good questions, make sure that those actually get submitted to the Federal Register, either through the ITAC process or through your individual process. Everybody as individuals can submit comments to the Federal Register, as well as through other organizations and associations. And I know many of you are part of those. Make sure that your comments get through the Federal Register. Otherwise, we really can't consider it. We can't respond to it because that is the Administrative Procedures Act process. So I think last but not least, my kind of editorializing on this slide is that, you know, it might be better to consider this session an opportunity, and subsequent sessions, an opportunity to provide, you know, commentary to your other task force members and to react to that commentary, then for ONC to react to the commentary. Obviously, if we can clarify questions based on what's in the proposed rule, we will do this. Either during the meeting or if needed as follow-up. So just know that those are the ground rules per the APA. And if we can go to the next slide. Okay, we are at HITAC meeting task force number 2. If we can go to the next slide, please. All right, so yesterday we tried to provide and paint a picture of the policy rationale for what it is we're trying to do. And just to summarize, we are really trying to drive transparency into an opaque market for how predictive DSIs, as well as other DSIs that don't leverage predictive models, drive transparency into the market for how they work and to how they ought to work. And so we have a series of slides today that we'll go through that try to provide, I would say, not a 30,000 foot view, but maybe a 10,000 foot view of the certification criterion that we're proposing. And then we've got a set of slides that are gonna go down to probably the 200 or 500 foot view. We're gonna zero in on the source attributes and really try and do our best to paint a picture of what it is we are proposing to require and what it is we're not proposing to require. So if we could go to the next slide, please. Okay. This is a slide that we went through pretty quickly yesterday, but this and the next slide, I think, hopefully will provide some context to CDS and the role that it plays in the certification program. Briefly, we have had a CDS criterion as part of certification since the beginning because it was named in statute that gave rise to the certification program. We had an initial CDS criterion that was pretty straightforward insofar as it just described what the CDS was supposed to do. The CDS was supposed to implement rules according to specialty or clinical priorities, automatically and electronically generate and indicate in real time alerts and care suggestions based on clinical decision support rules and evidence grade, and track, record, and generate reports on the number of alerts responded to by a user. This was very early days in the certification program, so I think 2010, 2011, as part of that initial suite of requirements. Later, the Health IT Policy Committee recommended in 2012 a series of updates to that initial criterion, and they essentially said that the updated criterion for CDS should display source or citation of the CDS. So where did the CDS come from? What evidence base exists for it? They recommended that the CDS be configurable based on patient context, is presented at a relevant point in clinical workflow, includes alerts presented to users who can act on those alerts, and is integrated with the electronic health record, so not standalone. If you can go to the next slide, please. So we took those recommendations from the Health IT Policy Committee in 2012, and we turned that into regulation text. And that is what you would find if you went to 170.315A9 in the Code of Federal Regulations. I think we'll talk a little bit about the differences, but generally speaking, we've had that criterion in place going back almost a decade now. And while there has been some changes on the CMS side relative to, I think those of you who have been here long enough remember when there was requirements that at least, you know, there'd be at least 5 alerts or something like that on the CMS programmatic side, our criterion has remained fairly unchanged for a number of years. And so I think one of the things to kind of think about as we delve deeper into this subject is that the decision support intervention itself does not get certified. The health IT module supporting the decision support does. And that's going to be a really important distinction as we move forward. The current CDS criterion for health IT module is, as I mentioned, part of the base EHR yesterday, I mentioned, and the base EHR is referenced in CMS payment policy. So pretty much every hospital and clinician that participates in promoting interoperability and MIPS respectively has to include technology that supports CDS and is certified to A9. And we are really proposing to update the base EHR definition to include B11, which is the new DSI criterion. So current requirements for health IT modules are essentially, if you boil down the regulation text, it is that modules enable interventions based on specific data elements. And when meds, allergies, and problems are incorporated from a transition of care and referral summary record. We currently also require that health IT modules enable, quote, evidence-based decision support interventions based on a set of data elements. We require health IT modules to identify for a user diagnostic or therapeutic reference information. That's part of the linked referential CDS that's currently in A9. And finally, we require that health IT modules enable a user to review, quote, source attributes. And these include bibliographic citation, developer details, funding source, and release and revision information if available. And those source attributes, according to the preamble text currently in regulation, ought to be available to end users via direct display, drill down, or link out. And we'll get into a little bit of that later on. Next slide, please. Okay, so here's one of the high level flybys that we're going to do in terms of what we are proposing to require for health IT modules certified to B11. So first, we propose that source attributes must be available as a plain language description to users via direct display, drill down, or link out from a health IT module. This would make a historic expectation explicitly required. And I know that we had some questions on what does plain language description mean. I'll say that we'll get back to you on that. There are some government sources, government like .gov definitions for what plain language means, but we can get back to you on some of those questions a little bit later. We would also require that if a decision support intervention is developed by a developer of certified health IT, all attributes are required unless otherwise noted as if available. We note that for decision support interventions that are developed by other parties, that the health IT module clearly indicate when any attribute is not available for the user to review. We note that other parties could include health systems, third-party software developers, and medical education publishers, et cetera. Next, we note that health IT modules must enable users to author and revise source attributes and information beyond the source attributes listed. And we think that this would provide flexibility to users to design DSI information unique to their circumstances. And then we would enable, require health IT modules to enable end users to provide feedback regarding the intervention and make available such feedback data for export in a computable format. And we note that this information should include the intervention, the action taken, user feedback provided if applicable, user, date, and location. And we think that this would go a long way towards supporting quality improvement for all DSIs.
Jeff?
Yeah.
Hans has been asking some really thoughtful questions in the chat here. I wonder if we can try to address them.
Sure. Let me open that up. Hans, do you want to go ahead and?
Sure, and I think it's progressing what we talked about. Is that the first one is that if you have the module that is calling, if you will, some other module to actually provide the DSI, I can think of that you're using CDS hooks or otherwise to invoke that, however, is that then the one that's calling, let's assume that's the EHR, and had to be certified, et cetera. But the other module is being called to actually perform that. The EHR is clearly needs to be transparent on what it uses and provide the information about that. But the module that has been called, which actually also is supporting DSI, and that's where I want to make sure the language is interpreted correctly by me, is that the one that is being called has no certification obligation in the way that you're describing it. Only the one that is certified for one reason or another and is calling somebody else to further support that. Is that accurate? I think I heard that. I want to make sure that it was accurate.
I believe that is accurate. Yes. Okay. Yes, that is accurate. And when we get, I think, four slides from here, we can kind of confirm that. But yes, I believe what you just described is accurate in terms of how we envision the responsible parties, the certified health IT developer and other parties.
And Jeff. I just thought to quickly reiterate the note here that for DSIs that are developed by other parties, the transparency within certified health IT would indicate if a piece of information was not available. So, you know, kind of a clear signal that information we expect to be available is not here for that DSI developed by another party that is then interfaced with or enabled by the certified technology. And the other thing I'd highlight with the example of CDS hooks is we do have a request for comment here about whether standards like CDS hooks could be used to provide that transparency information into the certified health IT, and would, you know, be very interested in thoughts around that particular angle.
And this is Steve, just to follow on to Hans's question, from a pass-through perspective, what would be the expectation of the attributes from the original source being included as the content provided for the attributes in the certified technology component? In other words, would the certified technology component be acknowledging the existence of the third party module as being sufficient, or would it need to incorporate the details from the third party module?
So the way that we've envisioned this is they would, as Jordan mentioned, they would need to, if they were working with another party on the DSI, the health IT module would be responsible for indicating to the user that the information is unavailable. And I guess, you know, I think the current, and just to be clear, our current expectation as stated in preamble going back to 2014, the 2014 edition, actually makes this, you know, actually made this statement that, you know, essentially we at ONC, we are not requiring for these other parties to provide the source attributes. And if we want to scope it to just current requirements, bibliographic citation. So if a health IT module today works with another party for CDS, and that CDS is delivered through the health IT module or called from the health IT module, the health IT developer is expected to work with that other party to get the bibliographic citation. And if it's not there, it needs to indicate that it's not there. And, you know, historically, we have posited that the lack of information in and of itself may be an indication of the CDS's quality and should at some level give pause to the user as to whether or not they ought to use the CDS if there is no bibliographic citation. And we provide background and point to the original source of that kind of preamble language and in the DSI preamble.
Thank you for that explanation.
Of course. Hans, you've got your hand up.
Yeah, just the other part from Jeff, what you described, want to clarify is then that if an HIT developer has EHR software that needs to be certified to this and they do everything they need to do, but they have somewhere else a product that they also develop in healthcare operations, otherwise, that does not have that requirement to be otherwise certified, they're using DSI, not interacting with the EHR per se, or maybe there is a variant there, but they're developing other capabilities that are used as HIT, but not as part of the EHR that's certified. Does this require that the moment that you need to be certified to this in one area, EHRs, or if you are more a general purpose HIT and provide DSI, do I now need to certify in other areas as well? Is there a ripple effect that the moment that you get certified in one, you have to do it everywhere in your organization?
We don't speak to that specific scenario. So that might be good, Hans, to kind of put down on paper and you know, okay. Maybe we can look at that. As this process proceeds, and if we can provide clarity on that question, we will.
Okay, great. Yeah.
Okay.
Bring whether it's already was clear or not. That's great.
Okay.
Thank you, Hans. Madel's hands up.
Yes, thank you so much, Stevens. I just wanted to expand upon some of the comments that was in the chat, and I'm driving, so I can't see all the chats. I just wanted to respond to what Jim mentioned, because that was one of my concerns as well. It seems like the charge of this, of the rule right now, the proposed rules to increase transparency for, of course, safety and to improve overall outcomes. But if a certified EHR, for instance, does actually interface with a third party DSI tool, and which then there is no citations that come forward, it seems like that would be a loophole for various different organizations using the certified EHR to say, hey, we're using this DSI tool, but we don't have any, that information's not available, but we're going to continue to proceed. So one piece for consideration is that since we're trying to add accountability for the safety of these systems, is then to say, if you are a part of a certified, say EHR, you're using and you're interfacing with a third party, that it is still your obligation to ensure that that DSI does abide by all the various different criteria that, as if we ourselves, as the certified in front, was the one that created that DSI. So just something to consider, that we need to ensure that there's accountability to support the transparency that we're all trying to achieve with this proposed rule. So just wanted to put that out there just for consideration.
Hey, Steve, could I comment on that?
Yeah,
that was my comment. She's... Yeah, to me, it just seems like I haven't been close to the FDA thing like many of us have. It seems like there are other levers in government. But for example, FDA's device, right? So these third parties that are providing, you know, algorithms for clinical decision support are considered devices regulated by the FDA, who would be requiring this same information to be made available. This rule is simply making sure that that's able to be expressed in the workflow. I don't know that certified technology, unless we redefine it, is ever going to cover the third parties, but the FDA will. And to the extent that they comply with the FDA and provide that background data, this rule just makes sure the pipes are in place for the clinicians to see it and benefit from it in the workflow.
Absolutely. Understand that. And I think that just making sure that there is that clear connection of saying, we know, for instance, that this DSI that's developed by the third parties, that it is complying with all of the various different FDA regulations or any other regulations, instead of just saying that information's not available. So just ensuring that there is that seamless connection so that the users do know and can have confidence that this has been vetted very thoroughly by all parties that need to vet this technology.
Madel and James, this is Steve. Thank you so much for your excellent points. Don't want to cut off debate, but do want to remind folks that please enter those comments into the worksheet so that we can track them and include them as appropriate in recommendations.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, great. Can we go to the next slide, please?
Just that, because ONC can take our recommendations that we provide in writing as they're looking at developing a final rule. Comments that we make orally as part of this discussion are not considered comments that they can consider in making modifications. So really good stuff. We just need to make sure that we're getting it back to ONC in a method that they can consume it.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks, Ike. Okay. All right. So, let me pull this back up. All right. So yesterday we did describe our definition for predictive DSI. And we wanted to flag here for you just what that definition is. We also wanted to flag for this group that we have a very specific set of requests for comment. So we describe and define predictive decision support intervention to mean technology intended to support decision-making based on algorithms or models that derive relationships from training or example data, and then are used to produce an output or outputs related to, but not limited to, prediction, classification, recommendation, evaluation, or analysis. The request for comment we have, and again, this is, we can, happy to listen to deliberations on this, but just wanted to flag this as an area for this group to potentially look into, and that is whether or not the predictive DSI definition needs to be modified in various ways. I'll note that our definition would not include simulation models that use modeler provided parameters rather than training data, and it also would not include unsupervised machine learning techniques that do not predict an unknown value among other technologies. So we've got questions there on, are there prominent models used to support decision-making in healthcare that are not effectively captured under this proposed definition? If so, is it feasible and appropriate to include such models in the scope of this proposed rule? So this is one of those kind of foundational points, information that we would like feedback on. We do, I think, by intent, and we describe this in the proposed rule, we describe, you know, how DSI as a concept is meant to be more broadly inclusive than what traditional CDS has included. But at the same time, we want to make sure that we're appropriately scoped for this definition. So I'll leave that there and see if there are any questions we can answer on this.
Hans, your hand is up.
Yes, clarification question by way of an example. So typical traditional CDS, like drug-drug interaction, other algorithms that have been used that have been embedded but are not interacting with a dynamic AI capability, they still fit under this definition, and it intends to be as well as the full range where you either dynamically or otherwise are using AI in the way that we currently understand it to learn and come to a prediction that is then offered as a recommendation. My understanding is it is meant to provide the full range in those examples. Is that accurate, that understanding?
Sorry, let me come off mute here. Yeah, I believe so. I think we actually have a slide where we can talk just a little bit about scope for various kinds of DSIs that are in our criterion. We currently have evidence-based decision support interventions, and we have linked referential decision support interventions. And we're proposing to carry those forward while also adding predictive decision support interventions. And the way to think about this is to think about which data the DSI uses and whether or not it meets this definition. So I can recognize that this is a little bit of a nuanced area. We've got another slide here and a few that can kind of delve deeper into this. Jordan, I don't know if you have thoughts on additional thoughts on Hans's question.
Yeah, well, I thought to revisit, you know, the slide from yesterday about the predictive DSI definition, which really is intended to capture these predictive models ranging from relatively simple models using regression techniques and others to quite complex models using neural networks, random forests. And that would be inclusive of large language models that are really trained to produce the next word in a set of training data where really it's a supervised learning task. And so that's what we're focused on here and is quite separate from the Boolean logic that I think underlies existing evidence-based decision support interventions.
And that would be helpful, and that would then lead to a comment, is that where is that line drawn? Because if we say is that a drug-drug interaction is intended to represent the traditional evidence-based Boolean type of logic, then it still used pretty much everything in here that it was based on research and otherwise that fundamentally does the same thing. The difference is that now a machine is doing it versus a research process. That's what I'm trying to understand, is that is it meant to be totally separated or not? But that would be then a follow-up question. Because that is where the lines are becoming very blur, because in the end, they're trying to do the same thing. What would be the next best step to take?
Right. Well, we spend a fair amount of time, and I do apologize for not having the slide from yesterday easily presentable. But we have a similar slide from yesterday that tried to articulate in a little bit more detail by way of slide the definition. But certainly the preamble goes into, I think, sufficient detail. And I think one small comment, Hans, to the last thing you said. If the intended use of the CDS is achieved by a machine, whereas previously it was achieved by a human, then I think that would be considered predictive decision support intervention that would meet that definition. But at any rate, take a closer look at that and provide us some thoughts, because we do intend to cast a fairly wide net, but we want to make sure that there is some lines of clarity. Okay, next slide, please. Okay. So here's an interesting aspect of the criterion and the way that we have constructed it. We have established this as a conditional, the predictive DSI aspects and requirements are conditional. So a Health IT module certified to B11 is not required to enable or interface with predictive DSIs, but developers of certified Health IT must make one of the following attestations. They must indicate that either yes, the Health IT module enables or interfaces with a predictive decision support intervention based on any of the data expressed in the US CDI. So essentially, this is asking a developer to look at the definition and determine whether or not they enable or interface with technology that meets that definition, and that technology uses any of the data expressed in the US CDI. There is obviously, as part of this attestation, a no option. The Health IT module does not enable or interface with a predictive decision support intervention based on any of the data expressed in the US CDI. So if the developer attests yes to this statement, the developer and its certified Health IT module are subject to applicable predictive DSI requirements. If the developer attests no to this statement, the developer would still be subject to applicable general DSI requirements, but they would not be subject to the predictive DSI requirements. All right, next slide, please. Okay, so trying to provide this in a slightly different format, Developers of certified health IT should attest yes if any of the following are true. The developer, and remember, this is a certified health IT developer, self-develops predictive DSIs for use in their certified health IT, or the developer's health IT module enables or interfaces with predictive DSIs developed by its users or customers, such as a healthcare organization or medical center, or the developer's health IT module enables and or interfaces with predictive DSIs developed by another party, such as a separate software developer, and the predictive DSI is based on any of the data expressed in the US CDI standard. Okay, next slide, please. Okay, so I know there's a lot of text on this slide. I apologize. The clip art was meant to help focus the mind on some concepts that we're thinking about here. But this, I think, Hans, is where potentially some of your questions may be answered, or maybe some of your questions will morph into additional questions. The construct of enabled by or interface with are terms of art. So enables means that the developer of certified health IT has the technical capability to support a predictive model or DSI within the developer's health IT module. These could be user, third-party, or self-developed applications, standalone applications used within or as part of the health IT module. And we do provide this example. If the calculations for a predictive DSI occur within the health IT module, either to or through a standalone app used within a health IT module or an app developed by a developer of certified health IT for use within a health IT module, we would consider this enabling. This also includes instances where predictive DSIs are enabled by default or instances where they can be enabled by users. So I think the big kind of takeaway here is that enables is really about the certified health IT being supportive of or a container within which a predictive model or DSI can be used, either as an app or as part of the health IT module. In terms of interfaces with, we articulate that this means that the health IT module facilitates either the launch of a predictive model or DSI or the delivery of a predictive model or DSI output to users when such a predictive model or DSI resides outside of the health IT module. Again, for example, scenarios where the calculations for a predictive DSI occur outside the health IT module and the predicted value or output gets then sent through or to a health IT module or to or through an app used within or as part of a health IT module would be considered to interface with. And then a health IT module would also interface with a predictive DSI in scenarios where an application is launched from a certified health IT module, including through the use of single sign-on functionality. So really the big idea here is that interface with is about the certified health IT being a door through which actions can be taken to launch or deliver a predictive model or DSI output.
And that predictive output would still come back to the initiating health IT, correct?
So I think that's a good question. Under the concept of interfaces with as a means to launch an application, that would be interfaced with. So I don't think that we've designed this in a way that has kind of closed loop scenario. So there could be instances, I think we have discussed, and in the preamble, I think there may be examples where there could be, under this construct, you could have a health IT module that launches into another system or application that has a predictive model or a DSI. And if the output of that doesn't come back through, that's not required for the interface construct. So it's an either or, not a both.
So that if I then read the definition and the example of enables, is that enables reads like it is a closed loop because it indicates to or through a standalone app, which means it's not mine. I use somebody else's, but something comes back and I'm continue to use it. Versus an interface, it's a one-way street. I initiate it and it goes somewhere, but it doesn't come back to me to further manage or present.
Correct.
Okay. That might be, I'll jot it down, but that might be a helpful clarification to make that distinction between two-way street and one-way street.
Okay. That's a good way of framing that. And Jordan, please tell me if I've gotten over what our initial intents here were. Okay.
I guess my only comment would be in the instance where, you know, a standalone app is embedded in the health IT module, but perhaps not part of the module itself. I'm not sure the two-way street quite applies to that instance. But so I think worth a close read of the description in preamble, because we've tried to summarize it here, but this is a nuanced topic.
Definitely, because depending on the architecture, that is a blur line at that point in time where it's embedded in. It is somebody else's module, and I'm communicating with it wherever it lives, in the cloud, next door, whatever. It's not mine, but I'm communicating with it, and I'm going to send something back or not. That's fundamentally the difference. Everything else might be a packaging thing.
Yeah, and I'll note that whether it's enables or interfaces with, the same requirements apply in terms of transparency. Okay. This isn't distinguishing in that regard.
Okay. I mean, even if it's a one-way street, Hans, isn't, like, if I'm a provider in certified technology and the certified technology is linking me in a one-way street model to another application, wouldn't the requirement still apply to provide transparency around what it's linking me to, even though the EMR is not getting a response back?
Completely agreed. The thing then is that then making the distinction between enables and interface gets a lot of attention for effectively no difference, because the requirements are still the same on what you need to document. So it might be helpful, but in the end, it doesn't matter which technique is being used. So I'd then be cautious overemphasizing it, because it leads to the conclusion that, oh, I may have to act differently. And it's not. But that's a clarification, not a further discussion right now that we can think about.
Yeah, this is Steve. To me, one of the confounding components is looking at the developer's health IT module versus system versus other descriptive word is a little bit confounding. Just as you start looking at encapsulating services.
Yeah, I'll just say that one of the motivating factors behind this is that there are numerous, arrangements and data flows that we are aware of. And there are probably dozens of others that get into nuances that we're not aware of. And I think what we were trying, what these descriptions fundamentally try to do is say that if the health IT module has the technical capability to support a predictive DSI within it, or whether the health IT module facilitates the launch or delivery of a predictive model or DSI output, then in both of those scenarios, in all three of those scenarios, we would consider that to be enabled by or interfaced with and subject to the predictive DSI transparency requirements.
Can you redefine or restate the definition of health IT module? That might be really helpful, both for me personally at the moment, but also in future presentations on it.
So a health IT module is any certified piece of technology. So we've got at this point some 50 some odd certification criteria and a piece of software that is certified to any of those criteria are modules, health IT modules.
Okay, because it feels a little bit, and not maybe this is the intention, it feels as though we're looking at, in some ways, the Russian dolls about putting things in buckets and buckets and buckets and buckets, and how things are encapsulated really depends a little bit, I guess, to a certain extent, on how things are actually implemented by an IT developer, as to whether they're integrated or a separate package. From a parallel example, I guess, looking at something like the ability to report data in the required formats to a cancer registry, you know, as kind of a parallel example. How would that, you know, many vendors offer that as an add-on module, not necessarily as part of their core base HIT or their EHR. So I'm trying to envision, from a development standpoint, how core does the HIT have to be for this to apply?
I think that's going to be a good area for the group to kind of opine on. I don't know that we don't really tackle the definition of a health IT module in the proposed rule. We have, I think, going back several years, a long-standing nomenclature to refer to any technology that is certified, regardless of whether it's certified to a single criterion like registry reporting, or whether it's certified to a host of criteria that, you know, many larger developers are certified to numerous certification criteria. In both circumstances, we refer to those as health IT modules.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. Okay, next slide, please. Okay, so this is a potentially difficult slide for folks to get their heads around, but this is one way to think about my earlier statement regarding we're not certifying the DSI itself. We're certifying health IT modules. And at some level, what we tried to depict here is the scope of DSIs that would be required. This is the scope of DSIs that health IT modules would have to provide transparency requirements on. And whether you think about transparency requirements as the bibliographic source or enabling users to see which data elements were part of the DSI, I'll just kind of broadly refer to those as transparency requirements. So in the definition, in the attestation slide, we did talk about how for predictive decision support interventions, all DSIs that use any US CDI data element would be within scope. And the attestation you can see there. For evidence-based decision support interventions, all DSIs that use problems, meds, allergies and intolerances, demographics, labs, vital signs, and procedures, according to the US CDI standards, would be within scope. And I'll just note here a small error on this slide. We are proposing a few additional data elements, which include the unique device identifier of implantable devices there. And then the scope for linked referential CDS actually remains the same as it is today. All DSIs that use problem meds and demographics would be subject to the transparency requirements for linked referential CDS.
And this is Steve, just asked for quick clarification. Any of the USCDI elements in the related classes or all of the elements in the related classes?
It would be any. So just to give you a potentially, a hypothetical example that may or may not exist in reality, if there is a predictive DSI that doesn't use any of the data elements that are part of the USCDI, then that predictive DSI and the health IT developer that enables or interfaces with that predictive DSI would not be subject to our transparency requirements. However, if the predictive DSI uses any data element within the USCDI, then a health IT developer that has a health IT module that enables or interfaces with the predictive DSI would be subject to those transparency requirements.
Okay, and again, a clarifying question. This is the USCDI, whatever version is officially adopted in regulation, whether it's 1.0 today or 3.0, depending upon the final rule and subject to change down the line, or how does it fit in with other changes in the USCDI?
That is correct. What you just stated was correct. It would be, and to get really granular on this, that would be the USCDI V1 until the expiration date of V1, at which point it would be USCDI V3. I guess just to give you another hypothetical example, if the predictive DSI was based on health insurance data, then it would not be until USCDI V3, which includes health insurance data, it would be at that point.
So yeah. the version of USCDI that's adopted in regulation or SFAT?
In regulation. Yeah.
Hans, you've got a question?
Yeah, to follow up on that that same question, Ike, based on Jeff's answer. So if a hypothetical USCDI version 3 is adopted in final rule as proposed, and then SFAP comes around with USCDI version 4, then at that point in time, if you adopt USCDI version 4 with FHIR US Core, let's say 7.0, whatever is current at that 6.0, whatever is current at that time, then you are not obligated to upgrade to your to now cover USCDI 4 in your DSI efforts. It's still with the base one for the duration of when the base one is in effect. Is that the intended proposal, or is it if you certify to the by way of SFAP to the next version of USCDI 4, 5, whatever, then you need to up your DSI accordingly as well?
That's a great question that I'll have to get back to you to confirm. My understanding of SVAP and the way that it works is if you were to certify using SVAP, and we can use version 2 or version 3, then you are certifying to all that would come with that version of USCDI. So we'll have to get back to you on that, but my interim comment is that the version of USCDI that this policy pertains to is the version that's in regulation. However, if you avail yourself of SVAP, I believe it would, our policy around SVAP and the ability to use SVAP voluntarily for certification purposes would then position you to need to support those additional data elements for this and for other criteria that mention USCDI. So I think if you put this in the context of transitions of care or G10, you wouldn't be able to certify to USCDI V2 and then not support those data elements in other transitions of care B1 or the API G10.
Right, or potentially enable a developer to utilize elements from USCDI version 4 through SVAP.
And there,
it's a two-way street.
Yeah. Hans, we're going to run out of time if we drive this one to the ground.
I'll try to beat that one. Hans, can you make sure that there's some notations about...
I already started to ask more questions because there's more new to it than what we just talked about it.
And thank you, Steve, for keeping us on. Back to you, Jeff.
Okay, let's see if we can get through the presentation and not have to carry it over to next meeting.
Okay. All right, so one next slide, please. And this is kind of the last slide on the 10,000 foot view overview, and then we'll dive into source attributes and hopefully the source attribute slides, even though there are many, they're fairly self-explanatory and a little bit, you know, less, they're more granular, so hopefully fewer questions. All right, so here's the proposed implementation timeline and real-world testing implications. We propose that Health IT modules certified to A9 would need to update and provide their customers with technology certified to B11 and comply with these new requirements by December 31st, 2024. And we note that Health IT modules may be certified to A9 and or B11 until December 31st, 2024. We do propose to modify the base EHR definition to include B11, and we note that A9 will expire January 1st, 2025, and B11 would replace A9 in the base on and after January 1st, 2025. We also note that developers of certified Health IT with Health IT modules certified to B11 would be required to submit real-world testing plans and corresponding real-world testing results consistent with other criteria that are listed in the real world testing condition and maintenance of certification at 170.405A. So this means that real world testing for all DSI types, whether they be predictive evidence-based or linked referential, would be live, if you will, for the 2023 plans. And measures demonstrating conformance to the requirements, of course, self-identified by the developer would be expected. And then the annual cycle of real-world testing plans and results should be publicly available for CHAPL. Now, I'll note here that our proposal for plans beginning in 2023 comes before the requirement, the December 31, 2024 deadline. And, you know, essentially what this means is for plans that would cover 2024, those need to be submitted, I believe, in December of 2023. So what we're trying to do is say that if you certify on the last day of the year, you still need to incorporate those in your plans for the year. So happy to kind of dive into that if that's confusing, but at any rate, we also do propose to add A9 to the list of applicable criteria for real-world testing effective as of the final rule and until it expires. So that means if you have modules certified to A9, you would need to include those in real-world testing plans effective as of the final rule.
Thanks, Jeff. Yeah, Hans has a nice comment, which is it would be good to have a visual that stacks up all of these dates next to one another so that it all makes sense.
Okay. Yep.
Let's go on.
Yeah, next slide. All right, next slide. Okay. So here's going to be kind of how we operate over the rest of this meeting and the next and final meeting on DSI next week. We're going to use these tri-columns as a means to try and talk about where, you know, provide the roadmap for where we're going to go. So today we're going to talk about the technical and performance related proposals. And the next week we're going to talk about kind of the governance related proposals as well as the oversight proposals and there and implementation and oversight proposals. And there is some overlap because part of our governance and risk management proposals overlap nicely with oversight and implementation. And so we'll get into those during next week's call. So if you can go to the next slide, please. Today, we're going to talk a little bit about the technical and performance requirements around source attributes. And these are, again, essentially transparency requirements. We'll go into more details on what this means. But generally speaking, we've got some requirements around source attributes that are intended to provide the ingredients, if you will, of a hypothetical nutrition label for algorithms. This is a concept that is well, I think, understood and well cited in the literature, and an area we'd love to get your feedback on. We also think that our proposals are supportive of health equity by design, and we identify race and ethnicity, language, sexual orientation, gender identity, social determinants of health, and then health status data elements need to be identified if they're used in a DSI. And then also there are specific source attributes that are focused on validity and fairness of prediction in test and local data, if available, that we think could be very helpful to the overall effort of supporting health equity. And then we'll talk last but not least, if we've got time, on the additional enhancements that would enable clinicians to author and revise source attributes, as well as this feedback loop capability that would enable users to provide feedback on how the DSI performed and then provide export of that quality or of that feedback data for quality improvement. Next slide. Okay, so as I said, there are a number of trends that we are monitoring and have been monitoring for the last couple years now. Largely are academic and industry-led. Most recently, there certainly are some more government-related activities, and we will talk about those. But really, academia and industry have been leading the way to develop and demonstrate technical and performance standards of predictive algorithms in healthcare. And certainly, there have been longstanding reporting guidelines for research around AI and ML. We talk and cite extensively the notion of model cards and data sheets for data sets, aka algorithmic nutrition labels, that provide information on the model details, development processes, performance, and maintenance requirements. And this is really to identify issues related to things like model drift when I speak to model maintenance requirements. We hyperlink to certain things, but certainly you'll notice our section of the NPRM is rife with footnotes. So just know that a lot of what we have sought to propose is based on the best available evidence that we've got, leveraging, I think a host of really excellent papers and initiatives. We also note that government and academia and industry are coalescing on the need to manage risks at the organizational level. So not just how did the algorithm perform on training and test data and then in the real world, but what were the governance and risk management practices that were employed by the developer of the AI model? And again, we cite extensively the NIST risk management framework, and my colleague Catherine is gonna talk more about that in next week's meeting. But we also look at the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, who has been pretty far ahead of the rest of the federal government when thinking about how to manage risks in the financial sector's use of AI. Next slide, please. Okay, so when we put together the list of source attributes that we'll show you on the next slide, wanted to emphasize that we didn't make these up out of thin air. The source attributes that we are proposing really are a culmination of what we identified as kind of the most commonly included types of information that exists in the literature and is used for reporting guidelines. Again, mostly academic, mostly research focused, but increasingly, this kind of information is being reported in evaluations of models in clinical contexts. We thought that the attributes that we identified would be most meaningful and interpretable in the context of health IT users and developers. We, of course, focused on health equity, fairness, and identifying issues of bias. And the source attributes were intended to show that the model would perform effectively outside of the specific context in which it was developed. So we've got a number of source attributes that are meant to capture the performance in local data if available. The goals here
were, unfortunately, we need to.
Oh, go ahead. I was just going to mention the public comment.
Yeah, that's Sarah. That's what I was saying. We unfortunately need to bring this to a close. So we've got a couple of minutes for public comments, but we can continue this at our next call next week.
All right. Thanks, Steve. We're going to open up our meeting for a public comment. If you're on Zoom and would like to make a comment, please use the hand raise function located on the Zoom toolbar at the bottom of your screen. If you're on the phone only, press star 9 to raise your hand, and once called upon, press star 6 to mute and unmute your line. So let's pause just for a moment to see if any members of the public raise their hand.
And also to acknowledge the 5 members of the public who have hung in with us throughout this meeting.
Oh, thank you. Not seeing any hands raised, I'll turn it back to our co-chairs.
Thank you, Mike. Well, I think we had a really good discussion today. I wish we had a few more minutes to talk things through today, but we will need to push that off until next week. Please do look for a homework assignment email from ONC. Included in the homework will be recommendations or suggestions to visit the worksheet, become familiar with the worksheets, and begin to draft recommendations and comments, especially looking at the DSI. We will send out the presentation material or the materials for next meeting as soon as they are available and continue our discussion. Stephen, do you have anything to add?
There is one more resource that we anticipate coming from the ONC to support your review of the relevant sections of the NPRM, I'm anticipating we'll probably have that available before our next meeting in a week.
And that's a new print resource or a new electronic resource?
You'll get it electronically. If you want to print it, that's up to you.
Are there any questions from the task force or any closing comments?
Yeah, I mean, I'll just say thank you to everyone for your participation and thoughtful comments. This is meaty stuff. And again, as much as possible, if we can all do all of our background reading before the meetings, come to the meetings prepared with thoughts, feel free to draft those thoughts into the spreadsheet so that we can go through them. All of that will lead us to a better place.
And again, thank you all. Michael, Mike, do you want to close us out?
Sure, appreciate everyone joining us today. If you're interested in participating in tomorrow's task force meeting, group 3 will be meeting. So anyways, we'll see some of you then. At this point, we stand adjourned.
Thank you so much, everybody. Have a great day.